feelings about 9/11?
One of the better jokes in that movie. Yeah. Welcome back. And we're back to Mike, and Oscar. I am your host, Mike. This is my co-host, also Mike.
My name is also Mike.
And we are doing the Big Sick, continuing our Oscar Sprint Profile series of covering all the major Oscar Award contending movies. Today, like I said, covering the Big Sick, nominated for that Best Original Screenplay. It warms the cockles of my heart to know that that movie is getting some play, even though, once again, on rewatch last night, I can confirm what I said earlier in the summer, that Holly Hunter has been screwed.
She's been ousted from that top five. It's hard because we love the five, and we're going to talk about it in our Best Supporting Actress pod, but also difficult to wrap our heads around because, like you said in the first episode, we thought she was a shoo-in.
Yeah.
She was rated high on Gold Derby throughout the process. I think the Big Sick as a Best Picture nom should have gotten more play, too.
I feel that, too. A lot of people online have been campaigning that, especially with there being only 9 Best Picture nominees, having a 10th selection, obviously, if the Academy wanted. They chose not to put anything in there. Big Pictures on the outside, the Big Six on the outside looking into the Best Picture category.
I wanted it to get a nod over a movie that rhymes with the Schmost, and I'm a little upset by that.
That was a Japanese horror film, right?
The Schmost,
the Host, yeah. That's the one you're talking about, I'm sure. Not the Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks.
No, of course not.
Yeah, that's,
the way they lied.
That you just like saying that line. So we're doing The Big Sick, the Michael Showalter directed picture. Judd Apatow is a producer on it. Another rom-com. We know how I feel about those. And this was one of the movies that changed my whole perspective on rom-coms.
Yeah, we're going to get into a breakdown of the genre later, whether Mike knows it or not. And I'm going to enjoy that very much.
I always love these surprises.
We don't talk before these microphones get hot.
So let's start the episode like we do. Mike's going to start us. We go on production profile. We're going to go cast and crew first.
Cast and crew first. Once again, Judd Apatow was the producer. He is a super producer along with Barry Mendel. We all know what they've done, or maybe not, so I'll tell you. Judd Apatow is the writer-director of The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Funny People, This Is 40, all the way back to The Cable Guy. Freaks and Geeks was his kind of debut show that he wrote and directed. But he's been the producer of Girls, the HBO show, Love, the Netflix show, Trainwreck with Amy Schumer, The 5-Year Engagement, Bridesmaids, Get Him to the Greek, Pineapple Express, Superbad, and then the Will Ferrell, Adam McKay stuff, Talladega Nights, Anchorman, and last but not least, an early part of his career, Heavyweights.
Step on the scale, son.
One of our favorite
Step on
movies
the scale, son.
To quote. We still quote that to each other, like every other conversation. It's insane that we haven't quoted it on this podcast yet.
I think that time's coming.
Lunch has been canceled due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
And I'm content. Skinny at Tony.
And I'm content. All right.
Now that's how the rest of this podcast is going to go. Flooding back to me like suppressed memories.
The Big Sick is directed by Michael Showalter. His other feature films include Giles Vanderhoot, which is a TV movie, Hello, My Name is Doris with Sally Field, and The Baxter. Showalter is best known, though, as an actor-comedian over the years. He's the protagonist of the Wet Hot American Summer movie, and he's in both of those new TV series on Netflix. First Day of Camp is genius, in my opinion.
He's a very underrated comedic guy. Judd might be properly rated. Michael Showalter is underrated, so he got a lot of good forces. A couple heavy hitting chefs in the kitchen stirring the stew.
Does a hell of a Ronald Reagan impression. He's part of that David Wayne, Michael Ian Black, Robert Ben Garant, Kevin Allison comedy troupe over the years.
He and Michael Ian Black had a short-lived series on Comedy Central, I think it was, called Michael versus Michael.
Yep.
Which
the
is
state.
The inspiration for this podcast, apparently.
Michael, there's another one. Oh, I'm going to step on my joke from later on. So I'm
good,
say it.
Good. Let's take that out back and murder it.
Showalter's IMDb includes 53 acting credits, including the films Kissing Jessica Stein, Signs. I don't know where he was in that movie. But
he was the alien.
Okay. Makes sense. The Baxter, The 10, Reno 911, Miami. He's also been in TV shows, Search Party, Children's Hospital, The Grinder, American Viral, Cheap Seats, of course, The State, and Stella.
You
and
have to stop saying Baxter because I'm fighting everything that I have in me to not quote Anchorman. about the man kicking Baxter.
I'm not even mad. Somehow, he was also in Law and Order.
Dun dun.
Yeah, he's written.
Everybody is, right? I mean, I feel like every filmography we do, yeah, that's how you get in the doors of Hollywood. Law and Order. Mariska Hargitay is the gatekeeper.
So he's written most of the Dick movies. Wolf. He's acted in a lot of David Wayne stuff. He's a co-writer on. But not Law and Order. He didn't write Law and Order. The film Big Sick stars Kumail Nanjiani. He is best, I pronounced it like an Italian Guido there, but Nanjiani.
I thought it was fine. No, it's not Nanjiani.
He's best known for Silicon Valley on HBO.
Yes.
He's also done a ton of TV like Portlandia, Kroll Show, sketch comedies like that, The Grinder, Community, Franklin and Bash.
Franklin and Bash. That was Michael, my introduction to him.
Michael and Michael Have Issues, which could also be the name of this podcast. There is my joke of summer. I knew I had it written down. Paragraph 17. Kumail has
Section 1A-47.
I think in numbers. Kumail has been in some movies as well. Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates.
Neither of those would describe my family. That's fine.
We both have brothers named Dave. We both need wedding dates. Hot Tub Time Machine 2. There's not just one, but two of those bad boys.
Because everyone asked for it.
One of the greatest ongoing gags in any movie history is the guy with the arm.
Yes,
in the first Hot Tub
yes.
Time Machine. Just for the record. Kumail Nanjiani was also in Sex Tape, Hello, My Name is Doris, where he met Showalter, Central Intelligence, Fist Fight, and he's a voice in the Lego Ninjago movie, which is, I guess, the thing.
What is a Ninjago?
A Spanish ninja?
Yeah, that's not
an
racist.
Italian ninja?
That's good. Ninja? No, perfect, perfect. You did what you got to do. We'll be shut down soon.
Zoe Kazan plays Emily Gardner in The Big Sick.
She might be the most adorable human being on the face of the earth.
Zoe's been in a lot of good movies, from Revolutionary Road to Ruby Sparks to In Your Eyes, My Blind Brother, which is an underrated movie, Meek's Cut Off, which is probably an overrated movie, In the Valley of Eli, Fracture, and It's Complicated. She's also been in some TV, including Olive Kitteridge with Frances McDormand, Bored to Death, and The Deuce, all on HBO.
I feel like she and I could have a friendship that would be like the modern-day Rocket Raccoon and Groot.
Sure.
She's just tiny and bossing me around, and I just smash things.
You wish. She's going to star in the TV movie Max and the miniseries The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Scruggs? Scruggs. Or Scrubs. I don't know.
I can't do it all on my own.
Oh, is that Buster Scruggs?
I have no idea.
No. Oh.
That was the theme song from the show Scrubs.
I thought I was finding out something new about you, like you're a country music aficionado somewhere.
No, I hate country music.
Okay. Learning more about the mics. Ray Romano plays Zoe, Emily's father.
Cancel Jason Aldean.
Get out of my shower. That's my Ray Romano.
That's perfect.
Anyway, he's, of course, from Welcome to Mooseport. Gene Hackman's final film, we all know.
He murdered Gene Hackman's career, is what Ray
Romano. We have a screenwriter who murdered Gene Hackman's career for that movie, but we haven't released that episode yet, Dead Poets Society. Anyway, Ray Romano is from Everybody Loves Raymond. He's one of the main voices in all 64 Ice Age movies. Do I have that number right?
Him and Kermit the Frog, I think, yeah.
He's been in a lot of TV, Ray Romano. Men of a Certain Age, Parenthood, Vinyl, and Get Shorty are some of his other TV highlights. He's also set to act in the upcoming Scorsese Netflix film, The Irishman.
Along with every other person in Hollywood, I think.
Every other Italian guy with my haircut. Holly Hunter plays Romano's wife and Emily's mother, Beth.
He's getting robbed!
We gave her the full biofilmography treatment during our 1987 Best Actress retrospective.
Which was a movie a performance we both had problems with. I certainly did, I know.
Well, it was the inspiration for the tone of this movie, Broadcast News, as we'll talk about. So Mike is a walking contradiction. For his Big Sick is like his favorite movie. I love pointing out your flaws.
He hasn't said anything false.
Oh, anyway, Holly Hunter has won an Oscar for The Piano. She's also been nominated for Broadcast News 13 and The Firm. She's won a Globe out of 7 nominations. She's won 2 Emmys out of 6 nominations and a BAFTA out of 3 noms. Her upcoming films include The Incredibles 2, and she was a voice in Incredibles 1.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Elastomom or Stretchy Mom or whatever it is.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you didn't piss off anyone by saying that.
And she's going to be in the new TV series Here and Now.
And I will watch it.
Yes, you will.
And then campaign for her to win an Emmy.
The Big Sick also stars legendary Bollywood actor Anupam Kher as Kumail's father, Azmat.
Hilarious.
The Affairs, Zenobia Shroff plays Kumail's mom, Sharmeen. Adil Akhtar plays Kumail's brother, Navid. He's been in Victoria and Abdul from this year. He's also very funny in that. And he's been in Four Lions and Sacha Baron Cohen's The Dictator from way back. Those are, yeah, they had their moments.
No, that's one I never got around to seeing. I was like, I saw Bruno and I was like, oh, all right, yeah, well, penis, I get it.
Yep.
And I just couldn't see anything else.
Penis jokes. Yeah. Comedian Bo Burnham and SNL's A.D. Bryant play Kumail's friends at the comedy
show. Two of my favorite comedic personalities going. I love both those people.
Kurt Braunohler, David Alan Greer, Vella Lavelle, Jeremy Shamos, Ed Herbstman.
Cancel that, man.
And Shanaz Treasury also star in this movie. So we're doing, I'm doing my best impression of
Tiffany Haddish.
Tiffany Haddish messed up a lot of those names on the Oscar announcement. Aww. Poor girl. But
that's a cheap shot at Tiffany.
No, I'm just, I'm
trying nothing to do with this podcast.
I'm trying to commiserate with her because these names are hard. You got to be like a linguist, sociology professor to get them all right.
A cunning stunt.
None of us are. So some production notes in terms of production profile. Judd Apatow encouraged Kumail Nanjiani to work on the script before he even got Silicon Valley. They met at South by Southwest, and Judd was like, I want to do a movie with you. I guess he was a comedian.
How cool
up there.
Is that?
Yeah. And Kumail says he owes Judd forever. After that, kind of, you know, taking him under his wing.
Yeah, Kumail, Steve Carell, Seth Rogen, everybody that you've seen and laughed at in the last 15, 20 years owes Judd Apatow.
Yeah, wait till you get how he shepherded the script. I mean, Judd Apatow. So Emily V. Gordon, the other writer on this one, said the elevator pitch for this movie really doesn't work. And of course, Kumail said it's about a Muslim guy falling in love with a white girl while she's in a coma after 9/11. And it's a comedy. So
he's right. I mean, if you laid it out as to what happens in this movie, you're like, why is this made?
Yeah.
But the way they pull it off is beautiful.
They did improvise some jokes. However, they shot really the scripted scenes, so a lot of the comedy is on the page. That's why it's getting, you know,
that doesn't surprise me.
Acclaimed for best script. At the SAG-AFTRA Q&A, the crowd gave the cast a standing ovation, and Scott Feinberg, who is the moderating guy that we know and love, he said, you don't see that every day. And Ray Romano says, you don't see that at the national anthem. Got my shower. The entire cast always talks about how they were scared of Holly Hunter going into this production, and then how she really just brought out the best in them. She's a totally giving actress.
I was going to say, they gave him a standing ovation, but that has to be due in part. You have like the most adorable cast in history. Like,
it's true.
Who doesn't love Kumail? Who doesn't love Zoe Kazan? Who doesn't love Holly Hunter and Ray Romano?
Yeah, we love the supporting cast, and we'll have more on that. Ray Romano showed his wife one of the movie reviews of the film after it came out, and it had the headline, Romano was stunning. And she, of course, says that they spelled stupid wrong.
I want a divorce.
So she's like the real Everybody Loves Raymond wife. I'm glad that joke played in the room. Anyway, moving on. Principal photography for The Big Sick began in May of 2016. It was only a 25-day shoot.
Wow.
Now, the screenwriting process took years. Another name that we keep bringing up on this pod is Mike Lee. Judd mm-hmm. Apatow is kind of a descendant, or at least a distant relative of the Mike Lee.
I would love to see Mike Lee's tree.
Filmmaking process, right? No, they never worked together, I don't think, but he admires his process, and he does, like, you know, comprehensive rehearsals with the whole cast beforehand, and then they do rewrites again. So it's not exactly in the inception process, but it is something that they work into their pre-production. So they talked a lot about broadcast news and their rehearsal process regarding the tones of the scenes, blending the comedy and drama.
It's so different. I mean, broadcast news has some glaring problems.
Maybe they're trying to win points with Holly Hunter during that process.
Please don't hurt me.
So yeah, I mean, I got a lot more on the story inception and the spoilers, but I guess we can go right into our specs, Mikey.
What? We're only 15 minutes in.
I'm efficient.
You have like another 25 to go, usually.
Look at me.
All right.
For once.
Let's do specs then. Can't wait until the spoiler section takes 2.5 days.
I wrote with economy for once.
I don't know what money is. Big Sick. Let's do some specs of the Big Sick. Debuted January 20th, 2017 at Sundance, where Mike said it got rave reviews and a standing ovation after its filming. Went wide on June 23rd of 2017 as well. Amazon Studios and Lionsgate have the distribution rights. It was written by Emily Gordon and Kumail Nanjiani, directed by Michael Showalter, as Mike just told you. A 117-minute runtime, only had a $5 million budget, and its box office total, domestically and internationally, raked in $55.85 million. For its total box office just in a theater run, where it's obviously going to be, it's on demand now, it's on Amazon Prime, and who knows what it'll rake in afterwards.
And everybody complains that the middle class of movies is gone. You got 5 million.
It's a dying industry,
Mike. You make
a great
movie. I mean, a lot of these Oscar-nominated films are under $20 million in their budget.
Yeah, but it also brings up the problem that we keep alluding to, whereas, what are the Academy Awards going to be? Are they going to be just the indie spirits, or are they going to actually morph into accepting more big-budget movies? It's an interesting idea.
I think they got to make better big-budget movies. I thought they started to the last few years. I think when Marvel and Disney really got their hands on
I was going to say the
things.
Dark Knight kind of seemed to trend. I mean, yeah. There was a lot of outrage when that didn't get Best Picture in 2009.
They're pushing talent towards those bigger projects. But you're developing a lot of talent with the smaller ones.
That's definitely true. So like I said, 55.85 total rake. That ranked it as the 61st highest domestic grossing picture of 2017. It ranked 90th worldwide, 42.8 domestic rake, with $13 million coming internationally.
A lot of profit.
Surprises me. I mean, $13 million internationally. You have a Pakistani love story, you know.
You have one of the all-time great Bollywood actors.
Yeah. I would expect a little more, but that's all right.
Well, Amazon Prime's selling a lot of subscriptions, so I'm sure they're happy.
There was free shipping with this movie. when we did our first episode over the summer, where we covered The Big Sick in episode number one of Mike, and Oscar, I told you then that this had a 7.9 IMDb rating, and it has since fallen all the way back to a 7.7 IMDb rating.
That's strange, because I haven't changed my rating on this one all along.
You don't know where trolls go. You don't know where, you know, the internet's a dark and seedy place sometimes.
Yeah, it could be.
66,000 reviews on IMDb, a 98% certified fresh Rotten Tomato rating on 246 critic reviews, 4 negative reviews. So thanks, dicks.
You 4 dicks.
The average critic rating is an 8.2 out of 10 on Rotten Tomatoes, an 88% audience score from Rotten Tomatoes, average audience score of 4.2 out of 5 on 30,000 plus reviews. It landed an 86 Metascore from Metacritic, which compared to its original screenplay counterpart stacks up as such. It is 2 points higher than Get Out, 8 points lower than Lady Bird, it is tied with The Shape of Water, and 2 points behind 3 Billboards. So kind of squarely in the middle of all those, that group of 5 movies there.
Mm-hmm.
Best Original Screenplay, much to my chagrin, is the movie's sole Oscar nomination, which, like I said, upon rewatch is even more outrageous after having seen how charming the overall movie is and how powerful and amazing Holly Hunter is as a supporting actress.
It's kind of upsetting. I wonder if the summer release had something to play with that. You know, these other movies like Dunkirk and Get Out, which was released back last winter even.
If you go back and listen to our first episode, you said it does have something to do with the timing of release for sure, because Holly Hunter, in our first episode, you told us, was on 15 of 19 Gold Derby's top 5 lists at the time, and now it's obviously dwindled to the point of where she's getting no love because of the nominations are out and she's not part of them.
You remember numbers too.
Well, it's a wrong that I'll be writing once I'm made the rightful controller of the universe. Holly Hunter will get every award, just not for broadcast news. On the circuit, though, prior to the Academy nominations, Big Sick did have some impressive nominations and wins on its resume. Namely, it won the Critics' Choice Award for Best Comedy.
Nice.
It was listed on AFI's Top 10 Movies of 2017.
Nice.
And it won Comedy Ensemble of the Year at the Hollywood Film Awards.
Nice.
So it's a very, you know, it's critically received, made good box office, made 11 times its budget, which is outstanding. Dealing with a beloved property.
I'm shocked that it didn't get a Best Picture, and yes, a Holly Hunter nom. So I think we're going to have some backlash bottled up.
I'm going to kill everyone. I went into my rewatch here. It was the third time I've seen this movie, but the first time in a while. And I went into it thinking, okay, maybe I'm overreacting. Maybe it's not as good as I remember. And I just couldn't pull myself away from her character and her strength and just the looks. I mean, you especially, you're on this every episode talking about the subtlety of the performances and the looks people give. She is telling stories with just her eyes throughout this whole movie.
Doing a great job. Yeah, she's probably one of my top five at the end of the day. I'm going to re-rank. I haven't really touched that Google document in a while. But before the
under lock and key,
best supporting actress. Before we do the best supporting actress pod, yeah, that's going to, I'm going to have to rewatch all these movies again. But rewatching this one, like you said, this was hard to take notes during it because you just get sucked in and enjoy it.
Yeah, it's such a good, it just makes you feel happy.
And I'll tell you one thing too. It's the same with all the promotional videos online. I mean, I'm like 30 minutes into a Q&A from SAG or New York or whatever film festival it is. They weren't at New York. And then I realize, oh my God, I didn't write any notes.
I have a blank document. I can't talk about a blank document.
So, I mean, maybe it'll pop up into my brain, the funny things that happened and were said and the information you need, but I didn't write it down. So
but
we
you won't
problems.
Be getting it now.
So, yeah, Mike, what were your expectations going back to the first time you saw this? Can we remember them?
I remember, and you and I both talked, and we both cheated a little bit. We went back and listened to our first episode just to see. Make sure
we weren't that bad. I mean, we were a little rocky at the beginning. Yeah. I mean, we appreciate all you folks hanging with us, dealing with our growing pains.
And as we mature.
One of the mics is not as good as the other. One of them. No, I'm kidding. But
he's talking about himself.
This one. So, I mean, it's like I got a kick out of listening to our first episode. I thought we did a good job with the reviews. I've caught a lot of flack.
A lot better than I thought we were.
I've caught a lot of flack for doing my Bryant Gumbel impression during the early
Don't part ever of that stop podcast. Doing impressions. I love them.
No, but
they're perfect.
The way I was speaking was like a sportscaster in the first 40 minutes. So, we are the Mike and Oscar podcast.
Ba-ba-ba-ba.
And the windup. No, that's the wrong sport.
No, anyway. It's the same. It's all the same. Okay. Go sports. Yeah, no, my expectations, I saw this later on than a lot of people did. I think I saw it after a month it debuted. So I was used to all the good press and seeing all the headlines and people saying how heartwarming it is. But again, I'm not a rom-com guy.
Right.
I mean, I hate it. We haven't released the episode, the best original screenplay episode from 89 yet, but I hated When Harry Met Sally. I thought it was, you know, you're glorifying all these creepy things that make people and guys think it's okay.
We're
going to
do a deep dive into Mike's psyche after the spoiler section and detail his romantic life.
See who hurt me.
I want to analyze the genre in the spoiler section because I got some interesting stuff.
So, yeah, I'm not a rom-com guy. I went in thinking, okay, it's just going to be another rom-com. It's really not. I wasn't expecting what I got, which seems to be a theme with me over the last couple OSPs we've done. I was pleasantly surprised, to say the least. What about you?
I can't really remember my expectations back then. It seems like another life ago after we've started this podcast. I think I was smitten. I was in deep smit with the reviews. But quoting, so I married an axe murderer. I keep quoting movies today. Anyway.
The night was moist.
Rewatching this, I wasn't sure if I was going to love it as much as I used to again, and I keep my rating where it is, and maybe I tick it up. I mean, it's just it's one of those movies that's irresistible.
Yeah,
in my opinion,
my final grade 1 point, I think. Nice. I'm like you. I'm the same ballpark there.
So production values, I got a few things, but you want to go sound to sight to sound? You your pick, big guy.
Who are you?
Look at me. I'm like hosting a little bit now.
Let's go sound to sight first because the
you
movie.
You like my hosting voice?
See what we have behind door number one? We're canceled. Sound to sight first. The movie starts. The first thing you hear, it's a montage of Kumail's every day as an Uber driver going through the streets of Chicago. And you have Devil's Haircut by Beck playing, which is a great song. And it gets you all amped up. So, you know, you start on such a high note. I wasn't overly impressed with the score.
It's like a three-note romantic comedy-ish score that's a little downbeat. It's like three notes, which most great scores are, especially those written by John Carpenter, your favorite. But it's just like... Oh, wait, I screwed that
no,
up.
No, can you keep
I'm
going?
Like a bird who's taught to whistle a song, and then a bird who was taught to whistle a second song and blends them together. Darn it.
What a comparison.
When I was growing up...
I'm like a bird who learned two songs.
When I was growing up, my family had birds for pets. I used to hate those suckers. But my dad would teach the parrot, like,
what
fight songs, college fight songs. But he would teach... So he'd teach him like Michigan, right?
And then I could totally see your father doing this.
Then he would teach him Oklahoma, and then the bird would just be nonsense songs the rest of our lives.
Every Rose Bowl, its head would just explode.
Somehow the bird escaped. I don't know how. I would.
Yeah, because you were torturing it. No, it wanted out.
Maybe it's, you know, flying around and as a flock in the trees somewhere.
Your father makes mini helmets to put on it.
We like sports in our families, but...
So you had birds as pets, and you have how many brothers? Can you tell the people? Four younger brothers. You had a house with five males growing up.
I have two good younger brothers, but no, four... No, they're all good. I'm the bad one. But yeah, they're...
You get back in the garage!
Get in your corner! Editing and the camera angles are simple. Something I wanted to identify about this movie, and I think it's important for all you film students out there. Look, man, don't get too showy with your rom-com, with your comedy, filmmaking, camera swooshes. You don't want to do that. I think you want to be clear. Clarity is king. So you got a master shot. You maybe got a medium, but you got a full head close-up. I remember a camera operator when I was shooting a comedy short film was like getting all mad at me when I was directing it. He's like cutting off the head of one of my characters who had like this notorious hat. And it's a 15-minute short. And like, why are we cutting off the hat that tells you who this character is? And it's just, that's what it is. You want clarity in terms of your shooting style here. And that's what they do. They're pros at it.
I'll bite. I need to know more about that. Why was he cutting off the hat?
Because he was like going to film classes as a cinematographer or DP, whatever. And he gave me some snotty response. Haven't you seen any movie before in your life? Like, well, I was just like, comedies should have clarity. You don't want to guess at who this character is.
So long story short, there's a dead body in Mike's backyard.
There's an argument that I didn't win at the time. I just did. I said because I was tired. Like, because I said so or something.
It's
as a
good
director.
Point you make. It does seem in the rom-com
genre. I'm winning the argument now, though.
In the rom-com genre. Genre, you seem to live and die by your dialogue anyway,
right.
So why don't try to over, you know, do all too many bells and whistles to fool the audience? Because absolutely, you could be taken out if you're just relying on dialogue as is. If you're too fancy with the cinematography, you could take the audience out of it. No question.
Absolutely, that is the kicker. You don't take the audience out of the movie. They can't. They can't.
The devil just gave you a blowjob.
Oh my god! Sorry. Unique New York. They can't dissuspend their disbelief.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point.
Please allow myself to introduce myself. I say things sometimes.
As far as being taken out of the movie going, and speaking of production value, there were a couple things, both in sound and sight, that did, I thought, were unnecessary and a little hackneyed. The scene where they're outside the comedy club and it's snowing, it's in the middle of the movie. The snow is so fake.
Oh, is it?
Oh, my God. It's like, I couldn't believe it. It's the same thing I had the problem in The Phantom Thread where you're convinced that there's no green screen, but I'm sure there is. It just, you could follow a snowflake and it would like go on Bo Burnham's shoulder, but then it would still keep floating down. It's like, come on, man.
My friend here also likes to win arguments for that from days past later on. I still don't know what you're talking about, but anyway. I like the montages in this movie. There's only like two brief ones.
Every rom-com has them.
Yeah, I mean, there's one kind of relationship growing montage, which is funny. And I forgive anything that it's funny and it's short, but there's also like a montage later on in the movie where one of the characters is remembering another character, like all their highlights. So that again, I thought they worked. They're utilized or weaponized, and again, they're funny. So that is a big plus for anything done in a comedy.
How about the comedy itself? If we're talking sound again, if dialogue is considered sound, the comedy, the comedic timing of Kumail is really great throughout this whole movie.
There is like a consistent tone, and it's almost too consistent with some of like the, you know, the family kind of makes the same tonal jokes as the comedy club people.
Yes.
And the relationship, meet cute, courtship. But it just works because, again, if it's funny, I don't give a crap.
Right.
I'm not
right.
going to judge.
That's the thing. If it's quality, if you put out a quality product, people will forgive some of the shortcomings that stare you in the face. And not that, you know, anything is a shortcoming in terms of the writing of this movie, but it's just it may not work if done in the hands of other directors or actors or et cetera.
So I want to save some of my breakdowns on the script for spoilers, but I do want to say, like, this movie's very giving to the entire ensemble, because even if you're a bit character in this movie, like the nurse at the hospital or the one of the dates he has for the arranged marriage,
that's a good point.
They get jokes,
they get
too.
A moment, yeah.
They all get jokes in this movie, and I don't know if that's something that's structured or something that was improvised or whatever, but it's really giving, and it's very nice to see. So I mean, maybe we start with the supporting cast, because I thought they stole the movie at many scenes, or at the very least you could say this is a balanced movie. It's not like a rom-com that's solely about the main character and you only see it through that POV. And I think as an audience, we want that. We want more characters to get to know. And I think that rom-coms from the 80s, perhaps, even though you get some gimmicky characters, you don't get to know all the other characters in these movies.
To that point, if you get to know a character, you're going to, obviously, that means you're giving it more screen time. That means it's going to flesh itself out and you're going to care more about it. There's going to be actual character development. Whereas yes. Most rom-coms, like you just implied, they are only focused on, you know, the two loves finding each other after a fight or an argument or worlds keeping them apart. Part of the reason that this movie is so charming is because you find reason to attach yourself to every character right. that's here. And never mind the fact that the supporting cast is so strong and so funny and so such good thespians in their own right.
Yeah, it's not just the zany best friend.
Right,
or the,
exactly.
Whatever, back in the John Hughes days. So the leads are pretty awesome. They do a nice job. I mean, Kumail hangs. He does his best to hang
he
with the great dramatic actors.
Really, really well.
Yeah.
There's a big blowout fight at a certain point between Kumail and Zoe in their roles, and I had a problem with him showing the anger. You know, I didn't really buy him as being so pissed off and in this fight so much, but later on he shows scenes of desperation and being just a man on his end and on
right.
Nowhere to go, doesn't know what he's doing. I thought he played desperation really well. Anger and fury and rage, maybe not so much. He was having a trouble keeping up in the dramatic lens there. But
right.
I was really surprised and impressed with how good he played a man on a ledge, so to speak, and just wanting answers from anyone. And when he doesn't have anywhere else to go, he makes a decision to flip out.
Right.
And I thought that was really believable, and I was pretty blown away by his performance there in that respect.
Yeah, I agree. I thought he hung tough, and I thought he, in a lot of different environments, and he could carry the movie enough where there's, you know, supporting cast could prop him up. And let's just say Zoe Kazan is extremely talented.
She's very, very good.
She's married to Paul Dano in real life, so I don't want to get too weird here.
Is she
here.
Really?
Yes, the guy from There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, good for Paul Dano.
But she is very cute, and her character is irresistible in terms of her likability. She's very
That's
funny.
All these characters are just so right. damn charming.
Very funny in her own right. She's definitely worth caring about as much as the other characters in the movie do. Now, that's extremely important and something I'm going to talk about and make distinctions about in spoilers, because she's not the type of character that is only a damsel in distress. She's not the type of character that is only an object of affection. And I think that's very important and very innovative and very modern for a rom-com.
It's another movie. It's another movie that fits the social movements of this year. You have these incredibly strong, I mean, the females are calling the shots in this movie for the most part.
Yeah, we're just evolving, thank the gods, in our movie conventions. After all those years of, okay, John Cusack's got to drive this entire movie,
right.
and we got to chase her down to the airport, and we got to stalk her to the extent that she'll love us as male
protagonists.
Which
is the whole problem I have with Harry Met Sally, yeah.
So some final thoughts, do we have them? This movie innovates a lot of rom-com conventions, like I said, it hits a bunch of them. Then it does something that's very important, and the protagonist takes a different kind of agency that rom-coms and other movies don't show, or that they basically give that protagonist that corner on all of the agency, because it's a male director, a male protagonist, a male writer, and they don't give the female character anything. And that's, so this is kind of a landmark move. I mean, I'm not saying that it hasn't been done in other movies, but it's definitely front and center here with a big hit.
Very worthy of its nomination. Very worthy of an original screenplay. I'm overjoyed for Kumail and Emily Gordon. It's first timers writing this type of screenplay, and we'll get more into that in the spoiler section. I'm happy for them. I'm thrilled. I'm over the moon. I think they totally deserve it. I'm happy that the Academy righted some of the shortcomings that we've seen in other award shows.
Right.
And we keep saying, you know, the Get Outs, the Lady Birds, this. I think these need to be the stories from this Academy Awards if we're really going to hammer home these movements that have been kind of taking over the social media space and the social justice space. And it's important to recognize these to the fullest extent. I would love to see this win. I don't know that it necessarily will. I happen to actually think that maybe Lady Bird or Get Out will win this category. It is a big
category.
So we'll see. But just the nomination. Good for them. Great movie. Definitely a watch, right?
You definitely a watch. I do think that the Academy tends to use the screenplay nominations, the original screenplay nomination, or the other one, to like give a movie some due when they're going to give a movie for Best Director or Best Picture to something else. So, I mean, there's a couple movies that we want to award this season.
Yeah.
And would it be typical and predictable of Hollywood to give Call Me By Your Name adapted, give Get Out Best Original, and then give like Lady Bird Best Picture, Best Director, something like that would make sense to me. Or give, maybe split it, Lady Bird Best Picture.
And then Shape of Water is going to be the turd in the punch bowl. Just going to ruin it.
Shape of
for
Water,
everything.
Yeah, I don't know. You can watch this movie on Amazon Prime with that membership there. You can stream it. It's available to rent, I'm sure, for $4. Streaming it that away too. I don't think it's going back in theaters. It's been available on VOD for a while now, so. It's definitely one of those movies to watch on a... I would say this is a Friday, Saturday night movie, the weekend movie, if you're looking for
something
fun.
It's a tentpole. It's a tentpole for how 2017 was in film. If you want to have a time capsule what the year of film in 2017 was, this, Lady Bird, Get Out.
Yeah.
Three Billboards, probably. Shape of Water, to some extent. These are the ones you're going to want to see to have a great representation of what was going on in 2017. And you owe it to yourself to watch it.
And I don't think we've talked about how it bends genre enough. Like, it's a dramedy.
Oh, I'm going to talk about it.
Yeah, we're going to.
I plan on talking about
it. But it's also a dramedy. So if you just expect a, you know, carefree comedy and that's all...
I'm not a rom-com guy. Right. I have a lot of problems with even a lot of the great ones. Like, I keep talking bad about When Harry Met Sally. It really rubbed me the wrong way. This, if you go in expecting just a rom-com, you're going to be pleasantly surprised. Don't avoid this because you think you know what it's about.
But it's not the rom-com where, oh, he made a nasty bet at the beginning.
Exactly, right.
And, yeah, that's what the sadness of it. No, it's dealing with some real shit, which is good, too.
So we're going to dance? Going to get our short shorts on like Army Hammer? Let's do it. Spoilers ahead!
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
I keep trying to come up with good, like, funny zingers to start these sections off with, and then I reflect on myself and realize that I'm not a man so much as I am just a book of 10 or 11 one-liners that have gotten me this far in life. So just pretend I said something funny, and we're going to do the spoiler section of The Big Sick.
Good job. Good transition.
You're here. This is to find out everything you want to know about The Big Sick, all the twists and turns, and what exactly The Big Sick is. If for some reason you haven't seen it, I mean, the movie's been out for a year now, what are you doing? Go see it now. Come back and listen to us. Or if you haven't seen it and want to just find out what happens at the end of the movie, what the twists and turns are, you're in the right place. But if you do not want to hear about the spoilers of The Big Sick or any of the best and worst scenes involved in it that Mike and I are going to elaborate on, go ahead back to the first 40 or so minutes of this podcast. That's where you're going to find all the box office specs and performance reviews and supporting cast profiles, et cetera, all the other stuff that you're going to want to hear to prepare you for seeing The Big Sick. But we are going to talk about spoilers of The Big Sick, and to lead us off, Mike has some story inception to dive in and get you all hot and bothered with.
So the big twist is that this is a true story, and that was something...
Ha-da!
That was something everyone I've seen the movie with back over the summer were shocked to see. That was something I was shocked to see. I didn't watch all the talk shows leading up to it.
Right.
If you watch, like, The View, which they went on The View.
They
talked about how it was a true story, and they kind of
Like I said, I saw it later on. I knew it going in, but it is, and that's why I said it's first timers writing this screenplay that's an autobiographical screenplay.
And it's amazing because Kumail and Judd Apatow decided to work together, right? Back in 2010, 2011. And Kumail pitched...
You think Judd Apatow knows talent when he sees it?
Yeah, Kumail...
I'm going to make a movie with you, and it's going to be Oscar nominated.
You're funny. Let's do a movie. Stewie voice. Judd knew he wanted to make a movie with Kumail, but Kumail pitched him like all these different kind of, you know, screenplays. One was a witch who becomes a ghost that Emily keeps breaking his balls about during the promotional interviews. The witch ghost. That they didn't
Here's
go with
a billion
that
dollars.
One. They didn't go with that one. And Judd finally heard him pitch like their real story, and he's like, "Oh my God, that's the movie. That's the movie I want to do with you." And at first, Judd and Kumail were like making a version of this true story where it wasn't going to be as autobiographical,
based
but the more they,
story
the more they
thing,
did yeah. it, yeah, the more Judd wanted the true story, and yes, there's a lot of artistic license here, yeah, but they
now you can understand why they would be hesitant, both Kumail and Emily would be hesitant to put this on screen. It's incredibly vulnerable and incredibly intrusive, and a spotlight on probably the hardest aspect of their life.
Emily was worried at first about telling this story. She knew she was going to have to give a lot away by telling it and a lot of details away about their real life, but she does make peace with that, right? She was shocked after screenings of the movie that people would come up to her and show her their medical scars. So Emily got emotional during the promotional interview, saying that she was amazed about, okay, she's giving away this story that's so personal to her, but then the fact that the audience reception gives so much back to her after this process was something she didn't ever expected. So yes, Judd Apatow kind of
strong
steered,
women, man. Strong yeah. women are amazing.
Judd Apatow steered Emily V. Gordon, who's Kumail's wife and co-writer on this story, screenplay, that he steered them to write the movie back in 2011, and they went through like a Judd Apatow screenwriting school. Every 3 months, they'd give him a draft. There were certain drafts he wouldn't even open up that basically would tell them that they don't know how to write a freaking screenplay yet, and that's what they said anyway. And eventually, as he kind of steered them in some general ways on how to write, eventually they started getting scripts that would work, and it was draft after draft. It was year after year, every couple of months.
You know nothing, you Silicon Valley dweeb.
Yeah, but he wasn't even on Silicon Valley yet, like right, I said. Right. So it's amazing that he's just a comedian, that this guy really shepherds through the process. Some of the things that they did take are artistic license on. The real Emily knew that Kumail's parents would not accept her, that she knew that Kumail's parents didn't know about her throughout their courtship, and that it was an incoming disaster.
That's interesting.
So that was something,
because that's the turning point. One of the turning points of the movie is the big blowout when Emily in the movie, played by Zoe Kazan, discovers that Kumail's parents are trying to set him up with all these Pakistani women, and that leads her to discover that Kumail has never told his parents about Emily and dating a white woman, which is against his culture.
So yeah, they kind of drew that serious conflict out over a longer period of time, a story time in the movie, which was actually kind of condensed in real life, oddly enough. And that's kind of unbelievable in a way, because in real life, also, these two got married 3 months after her sickness.
And it's one of the nice things about the movie, too. You see in the credits, you see, just in case you didn't know this was a real story, you see the photographs from their real life. It's a picture from the wedding with Kumail and Emily next to Kumail's parents and finally accepting her and blah, blah, blah.
So Kumail finally pitched a story to Judd Apatow.
You sure he didn't fish it to him?
before they did all the drafts. And he brings his actual bag of devotion that he showed to Emily.
Oh, no shit.
And uses that as props to pitch the story.
Open your heart to me.
You have a great voice.
Thank you. I took lessons for that 1 3-second spat.
So to go over those drafts now, Kumail sits down with Emily to write the actual script. And basically, they write one draft that's just all truth. and they hand that in, and then they're like, this is the least movie-ish screenplay right. we've ever read. And they knew that going in, but they just wanted to start somewhere. And after that, they were like, all right, let's make it as good of a movie as we can. Now, Kumail...
That's interesting, too, that they started that. Have I said interesting enough for you? It's cool that they started that way, because this is a very against type, and I'm going to get into it once we're done with the story convention. It's a very against type rom-com. I mean, there's right. definitely the love story and the struggle and the breaking up and getting back together that rom-coms have. But a lot of the conventions of rom-coms have been broken, and I would think it comes from a place of starting
right.
with a life story, because true life is not like rom-coms, believe no, it or not.
Absolutely.
Hugh Grant buys prostitutes. He doesn't propose to Julia Roberts.
Kumail hadn't grappled with the emotional toll that it really took on him, this event back when, and him and Emily really hadn't talked about it and flushed everything out over the years.
Yeesh.
As much as they thought they had. When they sat down to write this, they realized that his experience with it and her experience after it and their collective experience with their parents, it was all different points of view.
It's like playing catch with a hand grenade.
Right. They were amazed by how, the different takes they had on this one singular event.
Fascinating.
So Emily is a trained therapist. She has 2 master's degrees, and she's not using either of them because she's a podcast host and a TV comedy writer and a movie writer.
I think she's okay.
Screenwriter. She's okay.
She's going to be okay.
But she recommends writing scenes as a traumatic experience therapy for people, because it was really something that brought them closer in their marriage. In other words, Kumail said, yeah, you should contact Judd Apatow. He's a local film producer. He's got a YouTube video or two coming out soon, and he'll help us. Help you, all of you, you know, dealing with marital issues out there.
Yeah, he's bored,
called
just Judge. Sitting around, doesn't have much going on.
Got a bigger laugh when Kumail said it. Bigger as in more than zero. Emily.
As most things we say do.
Emily said that her parents have never cheated on one another. That was something they threw in the movie. And then Kumail, of course, says that you know of.
Oh.
Yeah, another joke.
I want a divorce.
They weren't going to put the 19 of our best guys joke in the movie. Emily was dead set against it. So was Showalter. But Kumail
it's
was
dangerous.
Pretty.
Kumail it's a dangerous joke.
Kumail wanted it. And I think, you know, the why it works in this story is that nobody laughs at it. And that's a comedy convention I think I mentioned in the first podcast.
And his character has already been set up all throughout the movie to self-deprecate as opposed to take conflict head on. And that's part of his character development, is that he stands up for himself as the movie goes along.
Right.
So he says that joke to try to break the ice, and immediately you could see the guilt on his face. So, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, that's comedy 101 right there, comedy writing 101. If you show a character getting laughs from other characters, unless those characters laughing is a point for the story or a point for the script or a point for that character, it's not good writing, because the audience, it's
yeah,
not
you need
like
a, straight
a laugh track.
You need a straight man.
In a sitcom, you don't want to tell the audience what to laugh at. So they tell that killer of a joke. Barry Mendel, the producer, said he actually watches people on planes who have the big sick on their laptop, and he'll walk up and down the aisles trying to time when that joke's going to play, because he knows they're just going to go nuts. So that's the biggest laugh in the movie, I would agree. But they weren't going to put it in.
It's a dangerous joke. I mean,
it
walks a tightrope.
And that Judd Apatow and Showalter thought it was kind of too mean or too edgy.
I was going to tell you people the joke, but Mike just scolded me like a child.
I mean, we've done so good at saying these other jokes up till now, so maybe you're right.
So it is a very poignant joke. You'll know which one we're talking about if it's in the movie.
Jokes.
If you haven't seen the movie yet, I would say just for that joke to judge it for yourself.
It's worth it, but 19 of our best guys wasn't what Kumail originally said. He said 16 in the first take, and Ray Romano's brother, who's an NYPD, retired NYPD cop, like charges in and goes to Ray. He's like, get out of my shower. No, he's like,
not the time, Mike.
Sorry. He's like, hey, Ray, it was not 16 guys, it was 19 guys.
Ray Romano's brother, of course, Jay
Kermit
Romano.
The Frog. The brother, who's an NYPD officer, corrects the joke because Ray was worried that he was going to come and say, like, that's super offensive.
Yeah,
you
like screw you.
No, but he loved it, but he corrected the joke. Emily's mom came up to their daughter during
Ray,
the shoot.
Why is your brother punching Kumail?
It's Emily's mom. So I guess a lot of the relatives came up to the these actors during the shooting. They had a very loose security on this damn shoot.
Like a third base coach waving someone home into the set.
Emily's mom comes up to her daughter during the shoot, the real Emily, and says, "Oh my God, Holly Hunter is so much prettier than me. But at least your dad is much more handsome than Ray Romano." So of course, of course, Kumail overhears it and goes straight off to Ray to tell him. They bonded. Okay, the real life family reconciliation stuff for Kumail and his parents. Well, he wanted to show the first few steps in like a 40-step process. And again, this is time-wise, it's a little more condensed in real life than it was in the script where he goes off and goes to New York and comes back or whatever. But those were some really true first steps, like Kumail going to the dinner and Kumail seeing his parents before he leaves and then making, you know, something for him to eat on his drive there or whatever. But yeah, I mean, the parents eventually decided they loved their son more than the rigidity of whether it was their culture, their religion, or just their own demands on their children for their religion.
And everybody learned something.
Everybody learned something. So Kumail had said throughout the process that it's not important to just give positive portrayals of Muslims and minority families. It's important to give complex portrayals of minority families. And Emily said throughout it as well, it's great that we have a portrayal of a real family to show you that they're just a real family. And especially this movie debuted during Trump's inauguration when it was that hot button with the
I couldn't agree more with that stance
military
too.
Military families.
And but I also you need a Muslim writer to write it.
Yes.
You know? I mean, you need someone that lived through it to get all the nooks and crannies of the experience to make it realistic
on
the screen.
It's not Rob Reiner or Judd Apatow,
exactly,
for that matter, telling
exactly
the story about somebody else, mm-hmm, and doing his best to be empathetic.
And you could
but
tell
this
the difference.
Yes.
I mean, you could tell it was
the
it's authentic.
In the
and that's part of the charm of it.
So Kumail's parents realized how distraught Kumail was when Emily was sick. So they didn't show that in the movie. They left that out. But again,
yeah, the Kumail's family is pretty much conspicuously absent during the entire sickness.
Right. They knew how much he loved her, and they still kicked him out of the family for a couple days.
That's
or
very
whatever.
Sweet of you.
But
get out of my house.
They saw how much he missed her. They saw how persistent he was in attending to her, how devoted he was. And eventually, when Kumail and Emily got married and he introduced her to them as his wife, that was the first time they met. They threw her shortly after a Pakistani wedding celebration to meet Emily's family
for the first time.
So that was really, it touched my heart, warmed my heart.
That's beautiful.
So that's the real story.
How come you don't introduce me to your family?
You're invited to Super Bowl. I tried to tell you, you didn't get back to me on it, you dick. I'm glad I brought that up on air.
We're going through our own marital troubles.
Well, no, the story.
I'm waiting.
Get your name tag out of chair.
Single
already,
tears running down your face.
No,
the story is fascinating enough. The movie is charming enough, but
stay tuned on the next Mike and Oscar. Did Mike 1 come to also Mike's Super Bowl party?
There is a 0% chance I would step foot in that house now. The part of the reason I was struggling because when we had our first episode, we ranked our best pictures up to that point, and
right,
Big Sick was my number one. And I was trying to figure out why I am so in love with this movie. And again, like I said, it's charming. It's got a unique voice through Kumail and Emily, and it being autobiographical, and you do see this Muslim family portrayed as a regular family, but it feels so authentic, and there's so many authentic pieces to it. This movie is like the rom-com version of Scream. There's so many conventions. First of all, there's a brutal murder. No.
I'm nodding my head, but my eyes are saying something different right now. But no, you might be right. Go ahead.
It takes a lot of the beats and tropes of conventional rom-coms and calls them out. Like Emily trying to keep Kumail at bay at first. They don't. It's not a big lovey-dovey scene when they first sleep together and then they both say, this isn't going to work, let's kind of separate each other. They address it head-on. They're joking about all that happening and how people try to stay apart and, okay, we'll never see each other again, goodbye, that kind of stuff. Kumail agreeing that it's a bad idea to see each other again with his tongue firmly implanted in his cheek. He's not doing all the desperate John Cusack standing outside the window holding up the radio unironically.
It's not about grand romantic gestures, which is why the bag of devotion is so awesome of a scene to watch because it doesn't work.
Exactly. It makes it feel authentic because people aren't one note throughout. I mean, there's the character, the relationship development and the character development. Kumail is changing. This experience has a big impact on his life. He's a changing character. He's not just worried about Emily taking him back. He's worried about Emily's well-being.
Right.
And he's willing to stand up to the parents to a point, not for because he's trying to make them love him. He's worried about his girlfriend, who he realizes through staying worrying about her and doing the things that a decent, rational human being would do, it helps him grow. And he does stuff that is still shitty. Like mm-hmm. when her parents kick him out of the ER, he leaves and he goes back to do the stand-up comedy and he's asking for reassurance from his friends. He goes, I don't have to be there, right?
Yeah.
And Bo Burnham and A.D. Bryant are like, yeah, no, it's totally cool. You left your girlfriend in a coma.
As one does.
Yeah. it's there's so many little, and Scream was notorious for taking the horror movie concepts and pointing them out and mocking them and making a parody of them.
Oh, that's so true. So I'm 100% with you now because yes, we've evolved as a romantic comedy genre over the years, and this is that example of the evolution because it's not just about him being the super stalker. It's not just about
yes.
him written by the single male screenwriter
exactly.
from the 1980s having to composite a relationship into this one grand romantic gesture after they realize they're totally wrong for each other and not explaining why they're
and
totally right for each other.
And it's not just roses and dust. Like, there's yeah. a scene where Emily wakes up in the middle of the night to go to the diner because it's awkward the first time you have to fart or shit in front of your new boyfriend or girlfriend. And that's shown. I think it's beautiful in the way that it's so authentic and feels so real. You feel like you're watching real people in real life. And again, we're going to get into the supporting actress argument where I kind of, that's my argument against Laurie Metcalf to an extent for her performance in Lady Bird, and who is actually the nomination I would replace Holly Hunter with. But nonetheless, that's how I felt about it with the movie's appeal here.
I'm still inhaling.
We'll get to it.
Well, I agree with you that a lot of romantic comedies past are full of kind of bullshit and stuff that doesn't work, and it's been criticized. Slash Filmcast did a great job, David Chen and company, talking about how exactly romantic comedies, especially meet cutes, are total BS mm-hmm. because a lot of times these characters are just playing coy with each other and they're just, you know, pretending that they don't like each other, and it's always the opposite. It's attract kind of convention that's played up to 11, and that usually doesn't work if you don't
show. Oh, you think?
I mean, maybe it works in some cases, but if you don't show the other person you're interested at all, they're going to figure you're not interested and leave it alone. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's grade school shit to like poke and twist their arm and do lousy crap to make them, you know, to pretend you don't like somebody, but that doesn't work. And it's funny, in this movie they use their hesitancy and their guard against the relationship, right? Because she's divorced and she's a grad
student.
Which
is another thing.
She's got all these things. She doesn't want a relationship right now. She thinks at the time mm-hmm. her guard is up, but she speaks about it. She talks
right.
to him about it.
It's
she
addressed.
Uses it as shtick, and or they use it as comedy writers as shtick throughout the scenes that they, you know, the small barriers. But those are the small barriers you got to get through.
So not only does it feel so authentic because of little things like that, and it goes against convention, and it goes against all these bullshit tropes that we've been spoon-fed throughout these movies for years.
Right.
But then, like you said earlier, there's an actual issue. There's life and death stakes in this rom-com with as far as Emily's illness goes. How many scenes, how many movies have we come across where Emily hid the divorce from Kumail, right? Quote unquote, hid the divorce.
Right.
And she finally says it. How many movies has that been the issue to
right.
drive them apart, and then the whole movie is them getting back
That's
together?
The end of the second act.
Exactly.
Right.
It's a conversation piece in this one. And they realize what really matters is people's well-being. It's actual life versus death.
Something Judd Apatow said to Kumail throughout, and I think he was glad that this story just had it in real life, never mind the story on the page, but heighten it. Heighten the drama. And that's great dramatic writing, and that's why this movie is structured as a drama.
Yes.
This is a romantic comedy,
a
yes, but the structure, the through line of the story is dramatic, and that's why it works, because you don't want the smallest conflict at the end. You want the biggest conflict at the end, and the biggest conflict at the end is life and death.
Yeah.
Okay?
A woman in a medically induced coma.
It's moving across
with an
the country,
coming across
losing
her, yeah.
your family, and all these stakes that are super duper high and real and built up to that point. So you get all the little stuff done first. Now, this is a romance. This is a comedy in terms of the dialogue. Like, what's great about the writing here, again, is that they understand that it's a dramatic payoff, that they understand that the scene constructions, like, there's nothing funny about the scene constructions. Like, we talked about Get Out, right? That's not a parody, but that's a horror comedy, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess they do parody some of the horror tropes, but there are scenes at the end and there are big action moments that pay off setups from earlier on.
Correct.
And that are funny,
right?
So that these payoffs are jokes. You have a script that is essentially a joke. That's why I get mad at Jordan Peele or whoever for getting all stuffy about the fact that that's a comedy. That is a freaking comedy. Of course it is, because you have jokes that are set up by the end of the movie.
Right.
And they're jokes with an edge. They're jokes that are funny because they're true, and the truth is kind of sad. So it's got a tinge to it. It's not just something that is just funny and we laugh at and it's easy to watch. But it's funny. Now, this movie is not that. This movie has jokes written throughout the dialogue, tension relief written throughout the dialogue, and that's where all the comedy is. The comedy is not a joke at the scene structured as a joke.
Yeah, no, it's also intense. I mean, it's useful. You need it to break those. I mean, when the scene were... It's one of my best scenes, too, as a matter of fact, so I guess that's a good transition. But when Holly Hunter bitches out Ray Romano in the ER... And finally, you know, the decision is being made as to whether they're thinking about moving Emily to Northwestern out of the hospital because she discovers that. And Holly Hunter is trying to make a call, and you could see, again, the subtlety in her performance, but the pain in her eyes, and she's just saying whatever his character's name is, you got to stand up, have some guts, basically, and she's thinly, veilly referring to him having cheated on her in the past,
right.
And saying that he has no guts and blah, blah, blah. I think not only is that a great scene, that's one of my favorite scenes, but then immediately after that, Kumail offers Ray Romano a place to stay since he doesn't want to go back to Holly Hunter's
Emily's apartment. Fish out of water thing.
And Ray Romano is not begrudgingly, he's openly telling, and Kumail is begrudgingly listening to the story of him cheating on Holly Hunter.
You have the Golf Channel.
Yeah. he's like, and you know that feeling of clarity right after you orgasm? And he's telling it to a guy that he just met.
Who screws his daughter.
Yeah, who's banging his daughter. I mean, it's like, it's purposeful, because that scene prior where Holly Hunter is staring daggers into Ray Romano and giving him all the subtext of fuck you need to listen to me because of all the shit I've forgiven you for in the past, it's great. I mean, it's such a comedic payoff because it's necessary, because you'd go high drama, icebreaker.
Something that we've talked about in the Shape of Water script, Three Billboards script, complete arcs for all the supporting characters too. I mean, that's so
makes
much
a difference.
Fun to have.
It
it's
makes
not
a
just it's a huge difference, and it's a just a example of or a light shined upon a script saying this is a great script, because each one of these characters has their own story in it. However long that story is, it's fully realized.
What was your best scene?
I had five scenes that I wanted to mention. Sorry.
I have 32 scenes, if we could.
I love the Kumail dinner table scenes with his family. The father kills me. The brother kills me.
Hysterical.
The mother is funny. All the dates that come by are funny. Again, this movie gives jokes to all the characters, which is really, you know, just an example of a script that cares about a lot of different types of personalities, not just the one male protagonist, 80s style. My favorite scene is probably the hospital cafeteria one with the epic joke in it, but I love the backstage scenes at the comedy club. A.D. Bryant and Bo Burnham, they're funny, and there's all these characters are funny, and the script is funny, like little things you don't notice on first watch, second watch, fifth watch, sixth watch. Upon my last rewatch, I listened to a joke that Ray Romano that I hadn't caught in my first however many watches.
And do you remember which one it was?
It was about the one he was talking about, the games he used to play as a kid, which was totally improvised.
Yeah.
And at one point, he just goes, we used to hit Jimmy, and I forget
throw the
what
chalk
he said,
at Jimmy.
No, before he's like, all you kids with your video games now and your $1,000.
$1,000?
What are you saying $1,000 for? It's just ridiculous. So, yeah, there's all those little throwaway words, not even lines, throwaway words that are funny upon rewatch that makes this movie great. But listen, I love the meet cute, the courtship throughout the relationship between Kumail and Emily. I thought it was genuine and real, unlike a lot of rom-coms.
Totally agree.
And romances that have been portrayed in the past. I'm with you 100%. I just think the key for this movie is that Kumail's job is not to be the number one stalker, like I said. It's not to create a composited finale for their real life relationship or any real life relationship. It is to basically declare his love, show her that he loves her, and to love her, right? With little
things.
Work,
yes, to work on himself. I agree. Like, he needs to progress as a man. He needs to, if he's going to be with her, he's got to make a choice about his family.
That formula, though, not only works for her, it works for his family, too. Like, he just goes over to his family's house. You're not kicking me out. I love you still. You love me still. Dude, let's not be idiots about this. I'm going to make this thing with my comedy, you know, cue cards.
And it's him standing up for himself. He's still the self-deprecating comedian, stand-up comedian, but he's standing up for himself. He's growing.
And he allows them. He allows them and hits the ball into their court and allows them to make the decision. Mm-hmm. Same way with Emily. He's like, listen, I can't tell you I love you anymore. I can't show you anymore at this stage. You got to make a decision.
I've done all I can do.
And if you don't, then that's your decision.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
If you don't want to be with, and of course, she gets the agency, all right? Not to be chased down at an airport.
Right, and he doesn't slam her against the wall and forcefully kiss her.
Oh, my God.
Like, right. It's the women are given all the power in the world in this, and Kumail, I think that is best illustrated by the scene in the comedy club where Holly Hunter and Ray Romano go to the comedy club and start the argument with the frat boy, and the frat boy says, go back to ISIS. Yep. Holly Hunter and this frat boy are going into a back and forth, and Kumail just wants desperately for that to end. He doesn't want the confrontation, so he takes it back on himself. I am a member of ISIS. It's a bad way for you to find out. I'm sorry.
At the same time, you think that's Kumail's scene, right?
Oh, no, not at all. It's Holly Hunter.
Going into it, you would say, all right, this is where Kumail impresses them.
Right.
Right? That's the point in the story where he impresses them, but here she is showing him why she's so devoted.
And then at the end, Ray Romano has the big emotional outburst.
And she is basically defending him.
Yes. And that's what she's decided. Yes. Like, there's so much good stuff in this movie. Do you have a worst scene or not?
Initially watching this, my worst scene was kind of the bag of devotion scene that fell flat, and I just never seen that
before
have a
problem
in a movie.
With it in our first take, as a matter of
fact. Did I really too? I don't remember it now, but now I think it's brilliant. You know, watching it again, I think it's brilliant and it flows so well, and I understand it now. I didn't understand it then, and I love how it's innovating the genre, and I love how it's just taking a small genre piece, right? A smaller subgenre, whatever you want to call it, the rom-com, and just saying, you know what? Good dramatic storytelling is good dramatic storytelling. All the people who watches this romantic comedy genre, the demographic, right?
Yeah.
A lot of the times, it's on Valentine's Day, and it's the lovesick who watch this, correct? I mean, I don't think
I'll
I'm going out of a limb.
On Valentine's Day.
I don't think I'm going out of a limb and saying that, right?
Eating popcorners.
They're watching Say Anything. They're watching Titanic. They're watching whatever romance on Valentine's Day. But this is like real people, real talk, real stuff.
Yeah, there's an actual movie here.
And it's, most importantly, honesty and truth involved. You don't get the nonsense and the fantasy. It's not a fantasy. I guess after all that, my point of this movie is Say Anything.
Yeah, it's a good point because all these rom-com, these bullshit protagonist men who make these grand romantic gestures where in real life it's, you know, stalking. It's not real. It is a fantasy.
And I would still say When Harry Met Sally is a story of friendship that they come together. And that's,
shut up.
That's genuine.
You're an idiot. I hate you.
You're right. The stalkiness and the gimmicks they use in that script.
Biggest creep in the world in that movie.
He's a creep.
That's a different argument for a different time. Well, I bet my worst scenes, I already went over them. Kumail trying to show the anger and the rage was a little forced for me, but that's minor detail.
In terms of how that scene built, though, I enjoyed, because they built
the structure
that scene
of it. Yeah, the structure of it and the execution
of
it.
Him and his
fine.
Family, like, he tells his brother about her before that scene.
I thought you were going to tell me you were in a hit and run, but not a white woman.
Yeah. So that was one of the scenes that's really put him on edge. And then, of course, they have the scene together at the grocery store where, because of what happened with his brother,
he knows he can't keep lying.
He knows he can't deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
issue yet with him and his family and the girl he loves. So it comes to a head in the scene between them.
Like I said, I mean, it's a minor point. I don't think it ruins the movie or anything, but that's what I had for a worst scene. The authenticity of this is so refreshing. It's so nice to see it. It's so out of place for a rom-com. It's definitely a more dramedy than rom-com, I would say, like you, the point you were making. But I also like the spotlight that it puts on the absurd gestures that, and again, it's going against conventions. In most rom-coms, the grand romantic gesture isn't seen in reality. Like we've been saying, the guy's more of a creep, more of a stalker, and if it were to happen in real life. The big scene where the big emotional outburst where the guy like could ruin a table or flip a table full of food or something, you don't see the fallout. In this movie, Kumail's losing his mind at the drive-thru, just trying to get a burger with four slices of cheese. And he finally snaps, and the big anger outburst is him throwing a trash can in the drive-thru, and then the camera stays on it. And you see that scene out through its end, and it's just a scared Pakistani man staring at a
apologizing
white
working
through a drive-thru.
He realized the kid is dense. He's not going to get any, the kid to
I'm,
be smarter.
I'm sorry. And he starts cleaning up the trash, the garbage that he just made. I just think little stuff like that is beautiful.
And speaking on that note, I love the giraffe. Him, like when you said the Holly Hunter Ray Romano fight that happens, right? I thought after that, like his immediate reaction is to go to the gift shop and buy her the giraffe. I don't remember if that's the place of it, but after the big fight, he goes and buys her this giraffe. I mean, that's like the big romantic gesture of the time that is just downplayed into this little punchline for the nurse to get the funniest part of it. Mm-hmm. Going, oh, you're giraffing it, huh?
Yeah.
And then, but of course, you know, again, it's the comedy hiding the ball is a negative term, but it's in terms of throwing you off the scent of what's really going on, because they talk about him and the nurse, the little piece of information that she sprained her ankle, which solves the
which
illness.
Which is the big.
So Dr. House is that nurse in this scene, you know, and that's just great. And there's a ton of little moments in this script that really pay it off. And I like this movie a lot too.
Obviously, my biggest gripe about this, again, is going to be the Holly Hunter should be nominated for the supporting actress role. We keep alluding to that. Check out our supporting actress pod. Coming up, we're going to have, like we keep telling you, we're going to have single shot pods for every major Oscars category. So we're going to do a Best Supporting Actress 2017 pod. We're going to do a Best Picture 2017 pod.
Yeah, we cover the seven categories, picture, director, original screenplay, and then the four acting.
Yeah, we're not doing adapted screenplay because we don't read. We're both terrible people.
Read.
I swore reading off after law school. I said I would never do it again. And then I read a show.
I listen to my books, so yeah, I can't even say I read either.
So let's finish up here. Let's put a bow on this. Big Sick, what did you have for a grade?
It was a B+ 89 after my first viewing. I've since bumped it up and kind of left it at an A- 90. That's what I had Moonstruck at. That's one of my favorite rom-coms of all time. Another
Moonstruck
one that was
very good,
pretty, you know, so it's on that level. And I loved it. It's going to be top 10 for me, probably.
I was 91 after my first one, and I think it's even better than the first couple times I watched it. I'm a 92 A-.
Nice.
It's just this is a great movie. It still might be my favorite movie of the year.
I wouldn't begrudge
that. The way it grabs my heart and shakes it, holds on.
It made me emotional again on rewatch.
Yeah,
I can't believe it.
How could it not? How could it not? Imagine the pain and the struggle this guy is caring for this woman that he loves, and meeting her parents is in an ER where she's on her death. Oh, my God.
It's a good one. It's worth rewatching if you've seen it already. It's worth telling other people to watch it.
I almost dread doing our best original screenplay category because I want this to walk home with Hardware, and obviously this is its only chance to, so I don't know.
Yeah, we'll get to talk about this again in those two pods.
Yeah, going to be interesting. Going to be really interesting. So stick with us. We're going to be giving you all the Oscar Sprint profiles. We're going to finish up. We've got a couple more in the pipeline. Then we're going to dive straight into these categorical episodes and keep doing what we do best, or what we at least do, I guess. You'll be the judge if we do it best.
We really appreciate all your support, you know, all the social media help that you're giving us.
We're having great conversations with people on Twitter and on Facebook. It's been a wild ride. We're already bigger than I thought we would be at any point.
Yeah.
We are already at this point.
So you know, if you can, keep charging through and telling somebody here and there. You know, word of mouth is probably the best marketing possible. So
we can't thank you guys enough that are spreading the word and spreading us on social media and tweeting at us and tweeting about us and posting on our statuses. We really, truly appreciate
it. You know, a review on iTunes, that goes a long way.
Yeah,
so really appreciate
it. you know, we're full of bluster and we pat ourselves in the back in the last couple episodes, but it's all in jest. We know this is driven by you guys and you're listening and you're taking time out of your day to devote it to us. So we cannot thank you enough, and we hope you keep up, and we hope we're giving you enough of a quality product to keep you interested.
Yeah, we're happy with this. We're having fun, and a couple more OSPs, and then category reviews, and then other fun stuff. We're
going right into Oscar Sunday, Hollywood's biggest night, Mike and Oscar's biggest night. It's coming. It's on the horizon. So if you want to keep in touch with us through social media, we're Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MMO_pod on Twitter, and we are Mike and Oscar at gmail.com. we're also Mike and Oscar on Reddit. We're trying to grow a little bit there and post on some stuff, so seek us out and see if you can snoop into what we're writing about. And I might be posting angrily on some wrestling forums to Mike's chagrin, and we'll see what happens.
We got to build up some credo with them, and then we can post our own stuff. I think it's a month.
Yeah, it seems
auditing
right.
Process.
Yeah. And then we'll burn it down from the inside. So stick with us. Keep listening. Keep spreading the word. Keep posting. Shout us out. Did you see The Big Sick? Have you not seen it yet? If you've seen it, what do you think? Are you outraged by Holly Hunter's being...
Snub-a-dub-dub.
Yeah, being snubbed out of that category. Let us know all these things and anything more. Anything you want us to cover, anything you want to hear us from us or about us.
I'm glad I'm not doing the Brian Gumbel voice anymore, Mike.
The 2-1? The pitch? We'll see you guys next time. Thanks for checking us out.